This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Talking History
with Patrick Gagan.
This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Leute, Argus, Akoiza.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, Michael Davitt, how he inspired reform movements around the world, the British aristocrat who lost a leg at Waterloo and who became a champion of Catholic emancipation. And then to end the show, we'll be finding out about the invention of intelligence. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com and we'd love to hear from you. And we begin tonight's show with Michael Davitt. Best known today as one of the founders of the Irish National Land League, Michael Davitt was also an investigative journalist, a Republican activist, a campaigner for prison reform who corresponded with Oscar Wilde, and a fierce opponent of anti-Semitism who helped report on atrocities in Russia. A new exhibition on his life and legacy has opened in Trinity College Dublin's Long Room in the Old Library, which focuses on Davitt and his many legacies. The exhibition will run until the end of June, and there is also an online exhibition. And to discuss the exhibition, I'm delighted to be joined by Kira Daly, the curator. And Kira is also heading up the Michael Davitt Papers Project at Trinity Library, which is cataloguing, conserving and digitising this collection of national importance to make it more widely available. And Kira, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Patrick. It's great to be here.
It's a brilliant title for the exhibition as well. Character is better than wealth. So where does that come from?
So that comes from a proverb that his mother taught him. So she taught him in Irish. Both his parents were Irish speakers. So the Irish is Isfar Clún na Conaic. And he wrote that on the front of his prison manuscript, which he wrote while he was incarcerated in Portland in 1881, called Joshings and Solitary. And that is one of the proverbs on the front page.
And his writings from prison inspired prison reform, and he campaigned for it as a member of parliament in the 1890s. Oscar Wilde corresponded with him when he was in prison, and he was seen as a major reformer because of those experiences that he had.
Yeah, all of his lived experiences kind of informed all the reform he set out to do. Joshings also, he has some thoughts on the education system and the education of the Irish citizen. And in his letters to his sister, he actually asks her to bring in some books from the national school curriculum. And he's thinking about the education reform as well. So what people are learning. He benefited from further education after his accident at aged 11.
Now, he died in 1906 at the age of 60. And I think one of the challenges with Davitt is that we remember the younger man and the campaigner involved with the Land League and the New Departure and all of that. And we really aren't familiar with his extraordinary later career as a reformer, as a member of parliament, someone who travelled around the world, Australia, New Zealand, and he had his Kodak camera. And I think what's brilliant about the exhibition and about your booklet that accompanies it, is it shows the full Davit, someone who had this international profile and someone who, for example, went to Russia in 1903 to write about atrocities against Jewish people there in a pogrom. And he met with Tolstoy, who admired him. And this was someone who had a major international reputation and a major international impact.
It was. I mean, he travelled everywhere. His diaries and his photographs kind of show the scale of the places he went. He also tried to write a memoir of his travels called Ballybrack to Jericho. I mean, he was in Palestine. In one of his diaries, he describes the orange groves that were there. His travel for a man at that time was just so wide and varied. He enjoyed it, but it was also a part of his work. You mentioned that he went to Australia and New Zealand. At that time, they were seen as some of the more progressive societies in the world for the people there, not necessarily for their natives, but in regards to reform, education for women, women in parliament, that sort of thing. And he went to those societies to learn from them and take this back to Ireland and the UK in his work as an MP so that he could try to make changes.
In the exhibition booklet, you've chosen some wonderful quotes and some wonderful excerpts from the documents that are in the collection. And one of them was instructions he gave for his funeral. He didn't want a narration. He didn't want a big, you know, recognition of him, even though I think there was a mile long of a queue for people wanting to pay their respects. And he wanted to forgive his enemies. And he wanted to be remembered with kindness. And it was a real modesty as well.
Yeah, I think he just wanted to just make things better. He suffered so much in his early life that he just strove in everything that he did to make things better for people. He presented at evictions. He used his journalism as a form of activism. So he wrote and brought attention to issues that were happening. There was an incident in Clew Bay in County Mayo where a ship of young workers was heading over to Scotland so that they could work for the season, and they all unfortunately drowned. So he went to the area, he spoke to the people, saw how devastated they were, that they were losing their income essentially, and he tried to get money back into that area, you know, and advocated for that. He really just tried to minimise human suffering wherever he could.
You mentioned the suffering that he experienced in his youth. Let's talk about that. The family was evicted when he was 4 years old. They moved to England. He was working in a factory. He lost his right arm in an accident at the age of 11. He was imprisoned then in 1870. He served 7.5 years of a 15-year sentence, but it was hard labour and it was extremely brutal conditions. And these were traumatic events that really shaped the humanitarian he developed into, and the kind of the character that he had, that he believed was certainly better than wealth.
Yeah, absolutely. Dartmoor really provoked his interest in prison reform. Like, it was hard labour. It affected his health for life, and that's partly why he chased warmth. So going to countries like Australia, because it helped his health as well as everything else. But his time in Dartmoor, when he became an MP, he returned 21 years after his incarceration as part of a committee investigating prison reform and trying to provoke it. And there's a line in one of his notebooks that says, "Today, what a contrast, 21 years after I passed this gate on a mission to try and reform this."
So maybe tell us about that work with the Land League and that campaigning for better rights for people.
Yeah, so he presented at several evictions. One of the items in the exhibition is a photograph of him and John Dillon and Daniel Crilly, actually outside the eviction of Widow Darcy in County Wexford. And he used those appearances at evictions as inspiration for the articles that he used to draw attention to the suffering, the tenants that were suffering. He would then go back and he'd write articles, which he then published as pamphlets, so that he could get as much information out there to the general public, so that he could draw attention to it and try and see change. He advocated for funds, which were mainly collected from the Irish abroad, so that they could collect money and that they would be passed out to the tenants. So anyone that applied would be able to get some form of financial assistance from these funds.
Tell us about his American wife, Mary Yore, because they had children, and I think it's through the children that his papers ended up in the Trinity Library archive.
That's correct, yeah. So he met Mary in 1881, and while he was on land league business in Oakland, California, and they married in 1886. Mary would have moved to Ireland by that point, and they had five children. They moved around. Mary spent stints in America with the children while Michael was off around the world doing good.
So tell us about the papers then, because one of his sons, Kerr Davitt, ended up becoming the president of the High Court, was a really impressive lawyer, was the judge advocate general during the War of Independence, and knew Michael Collins, and then afterwards becomes a legal officer. I think as president of the High Court, he sat on the Supreme Court, and he developed a great friendship with the historian T.W. Moody.
That's correct, yeah. So the papers came to us through Moody. They were deposited on a loan to us while Moody worked on them. He used them in his book, Davitt and the Irish Revolution. And then they were officially donated to us then in 1982. Moody wrote the catalogue that has been in use for years, and which is great to have. A historian, a Davitt expert writing your catalogue is exactly what you want. But he highlighted different things at that time that he felt were important. The work I'm trying to do as the archivist is to create more entry points into the collection. So a previous project catalogued all of the 550 photographs. It improved some of the language to make it more modern and more accessible and to make the language less offensive. And this worked really well because it adds so much more to the catalogue to have more entry points. So you know that this is when he was in Russia, that when he was in Australia, he met Aboriginal Australians. There's way more context now to those photographs than there was in Moody's original catalogue. So it's just adding to the body of work that we already have. My work is going to do that with the rest of the collection.
How do you think Davitt is viewed today in Ireland? Is he... He perhaps doesn't get the recognition that he fully deserves. It mainly focuses on just one part of the career.
Yeah, everyone seems to know him, and it's all for the work that he did at the Land League, and for the Land League, which was amazing work, really. And it's why he's well known. But I think the rest of his career is just so interesting. The journalism, some of his reporting in Russia on the pogrom was some of the most unbiased in the world at that time. And it just, I suppose it just gives a different insight into the man. People didn't know that he travelled that far. You know, they didn't know that he worked on prison reform. He started the campaigning for pensions for older people. He didn't get that across the line before he died, but they eventually, pensions started to become a thing in 1908. And he just really, it's such a wide and varied career, I think, that people don't necessarily know about, and it's important too.
So what would you like people to take away from the exhibition? What new perspective on the life and legacy of Davitt?
I suppose I'd just like them to have learned something new, just to learn more about how wide his legacy was and how much he did achieve, because he achieved a lot, and some of it might have been to the detriment of his family when he was going to Australia. Unfortunately, his daughter Kathleen died, and his wife told him to bear up and complete the mission, because she knew that going to Australia was one of his life's ambitions, to go out there and to lecture out there and to meet the people. So devoted to the cause. So I just want to get that across, how devoted he was and even how human he was. The whole exhibition was inspired by a questionnaire that he filled in. And my favourite fact is that his favourite colour is light purple. I really enjoy knowing that, and that's really fun. That's a fun fact that I can wheel out at any given point.
Breaking news on Talking History.
Yeah.
The favourite cut. Brilliant. And the exhibition is running until the end of June, and there is a wonderful online exhibition as well.
There is, yeah. So the online exhibition has the videos that appear in the long room, and it has the bulk of what's in the cases. And as my role as archivist, the rest of the items have all been digitised. And they're all available through the library website, as well as we're working our way through the rest of the collection as well.
Well, it's a brilliant new exhibition in the Old Library in Trinity College, Dublin. I'm delighted to have been joined by Ciara Daly, who's the creator of the exhibition, and she is also heading up the Michael Davitt Papers Project at the Trinity College, Dublin Library. Ciara, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. We continue tonight's show with the story of a man who arrived in Ireland as a celebrated war hero, but quickly discovered that governing a restless country in peacetime could be more dangerous than any battlefield. Henry Paget, the Marquess of Anglesey, had lost a leg at Waterloo and won a reputation for courage and charisma. But when he became Lord Lieutenant of Ireland in 1828, he walked straight into a political minefield. And to talk about that minefield and what happened afterwards, I'm delighted to be joined by historian Sheila McGuckian, whose new book, Anglesey in Ireland, 1828 to 1833, Worse Than War, examines his personality, principle and how power collided at a crucial moment in Irish history. And the book is published in hardback by Four Courts Press. Sheila, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us about Anglesey, and maybe we'll even start with his career before he came to Ireland, and I suppose his involvement in the hugely iconic Battle of Waterloo.
Well, Anglesey had a very interesting background. His father was a peer, an earl, and he inherited the title. He became Lord Uxbridge quite early in his life, in about 1812. And before that, he had pursued a career, and actually at that time, he pursued a career as a cavalryman. And that brought him to his most successful time as a cavalryman, which was in Spain in 1808 to 1809. And it was at this time that Napoleon had conquered huge parts of Europe. And the British had essentially been locked out of Europe again, as similar happened in the next century, in the 1940s. And what happened was an attempt was made to go back into Spain through Spain and Portugal. And this was led by Sir John Moore, who was the great general at the time, and it was a disaster. The British army was chased out of Spain, and it ended up very similar to what happened in Dunkirk, having to be evacuated from the city of Corunna. And in order for the army to get away, it was necessary for somebody to hold off the French forces, and that fell to the cavalry and to Henry Paget himself. In doing that, his actions allowed the British army to get away. He obviously escaped with them. And unfortunately, Sir John Moore was killed in the retreat. So when they returned to Britain again, it was seen very much as a success, even though they'd been thrown out of Europe. And it was Paget who was regarded as the hero. So he came back to Britain at that time. He was a married man, a very wealthy man, very well connected in the British courts and a court and society. But unfortunately, he fell in love with a woman who was married to someone else at the time. They had a very dramatic affair. Both of them left their partners. It was a huge scandal. And her partner was the younger brother of the Duke of Wellington. So following this divorce, it broke up the marriage, obviously, and massive scandal. The young woman, her name was Charlotte Cadogan, and her brother fought a duel with Anglesey. Mind you, both of them came.
He seems to have a fondness for the brothers, the wives of the brothers of the Duke of Wellington, because he had an affair with two of those wives.
That's the unbelievable thing. Now, people only really knew about the first one because it broke up the marriage. So, you know, he ended up getting sued in court. It was all very, very scandalous at the time. And but he also quietly and not so well known had an affair with her sister, who was married to another of the brothers of the Duke of Wellington, Gerard Wesley at that time. And this, even by Regency standards, this was a scandal too far. And really, it was as a result of this, in the next few years, as Britain started to really get a hold in Europe, in the peninsula, under the Duke of Wellington, Paget should have been there, but he wasn't. And part of the reason was given was the fallout from these two affairs with the two sisters. So he was excluded from those, but he was still very much viewed as the greatest cavalryman of his generation.
And I think Wellington had no choice but to have him there at Waterloo.
Right. Yes, Wellington actually wanted somebody else. He wanted Lord Combermere, but the powers that be said, no, you have to have Anglesey, who was Paget at the time. So, June 1815, the two of them end up at the Battle Battle of Waterloo. And interestingly, the night before Anglesey records that he realised that he was going to be the second in command of the entire Allied forces. Wellington had given him no idea of his plans for the following day. So he sort of said to him, you know, look, if anything happens tomorrow, is there any chance, you know, that you could tell me what our plan is? And Wellington, typically Delphic, said, well, Napoleon hasn't told me his plan, so how can I be expected to know? And that was it. So the day developed, as we know, it was a very, very close, hard fought battle. Anglesey led a number of very successful cavalry manoeuvres and was across the field the whole time, really distinguished himself extremely well. And in the very last moments of the battle, as himself and Wellington were beside each other, viewing the final actions, a cannonball came and took off his leg. And famously, Wellington is supposed to have said to him, my goodness, you've lost your leg. To which Angus said, by God, so I have. So once again, he was very much regarded as a hero after that. And that was the last sort of full action that he saw until he came to Ireland.
So tell us how he ends up then in Ireland as Lord Lieutenant or Lord Lieutenant. And it's interesting the fact that the Duke of Wellington is now the Prime Minister.
Yes.
And maybe some of the tensions that were in the relationship, they resurface at this time as well?
Hard to say, because so what had happened was Anglesey late in life, he was 57 by the time he actually joined the cabinet, and by this stage he had been given the Marquisate Anglesey, and that's how he was known. He was originally Master of the Ordnance. He was seen as a very sensible, solid pair of hands, very able, not enormous amount of experience in diplomacy. And he, but he'd always quite liked the idea, very good leader, and he liked the idea of the Irish Lord Lieutenancy. And that had been held by Richard Wellesley, who was actually the older brother of the Duke of Wellington. So you have these remarkable family connections. When he was standing down, the Prime Minister at the time was Lord Canning, who was regarded very much as a liberal in, you know, early 19th century terms. He was happy to appoint Anglesey. And in fact, one of the reasons that he was being appointed was he was viewed as kind of conservative and kind of supportive of the Protestant ascendancy. But in this, actually, they'd miscalculated. He was much more liberal than was seen. So he was appointed the position, but he didn't take it up until January, by which stage Canning had died and Wellington had become Prime Minister. And Wellington was a much, much more conservative figure. And actually, Anglesey had concerns about going in with Wellington because he was very much in favour of Catholic emancipation and also generally had a more liberal outlook. But Wellington was keen to have him. He reckoned he was it was a very difficult job. It took somebody with leadership skills, and he regarded him as a very able person that he felt could deal with it. So he ended up in the position.
And this was the great era of the campaign for Catholic emancipation and the leadership of Daniel O'Connell. What did O'Connell think of Anglesey?
Yeah, he was pleased in the beginning to have him. He was a new person coming in. He was supported by William Lamb, who was to become Lord Melbourne, with whom O'Connell had a good relationship. O'Connell hated Wellington, and it was mutual. So he kind of felt that having Anglesey in, he was a little wary about him, but he was reasonably enthusiastic. And very quickly, it became clear that the crisis point had arrived with the Clare election. And Wellington realised this, but he very much had this view that he realised it was inevitable that Catholic emancipation had to happen. But he took the view that it was for Ireland to buckle down and that Britain, when it was ready, would grant it. And in the meantime, it was necessary in order to bring the Protestant ascendancy on board to take a very hard line. Whereas Anglesey realised this was disastrous. I mean, you know, they had lost 80% of the country at this stage. And he was much more conciliatory. And he very much supported the Catholic emancipation movement. And although, like, he had his qualms about certain of O'Connell's motivations, he was supportive of the movement. And as the months went on, he became more openly supportive of Catholic emancipation, to the horror of Wellington, who
thought he had gone mad or had been completely taken over on the Catholic side.
Well, as things worsened in the October, Wellington actually wrote in massive frustration to Lord Bathurst that Anglesey had been bitten by a mad papist, contacted sort of Catholic rabies or something. But over the course of this period, Wellington was taking a very hard line and Anglesey was openly supporting Catholic emancipation. And Wellington argued this made it very difficult to persuade the king, who was furious with Anglesey. He kept trying to get him fired. And Wellington kept saying it's not possible because he's so popular in Ireland. So there was a massive distance between the two of them at that time.
And yet it did go wrong for him and he was recalled.
Well, it's hard to say whether it actually went wrong, because what he did was he pushed so hard that finally Wellington, who was one of these very patient people who expected people to do what they were told, didn't particularly like confrontation, wrote to him and said, look, enough, you're way out of line, you're making my life so difficult. And they had this very, very, it's actually quite funny to read, but really angry correspondence between the two of them. And Anglesey reckoned that Wellington wanted him to resign and just go, but Anglesey was refusing to. He said, look, I'm the last person that's, you know, holding the line. If he went, far from what Wellington thought, things being easier, actually the whole thing could have collapsed into chaos, and that's not impossible that that would have happened. So they have this massive correspondence, and at the end of it, Wellington fires Anglesey. But before Anglesey left, he had learned that Wellington was actually in favour of Catholic emancipation when the time was right. So this was, you know, it wasn't the break that it appeared. And he caused correspondence to be published outing Wellington's secret plans, which caused absolute furore. And he'd been given time to leave. And once that was published, it was like, right, off now. But it was very effective. It meant that within, who knows what Wellington's timeline would have been and what could have developed in Ireland in the meantime. But as a result of that, Anglesey was forced to leave in January, and in March, February in fact, Peel and Wellington announced Catholic emancipation. It just brought it much, much further forward. So it was actually effective.
It was effective. Now, he's not out of Ireland for too long, because there is a change of administration, and when Lord Grey comes in, mm-hmm. he returns to Ireland as Lord Lieutenant.
Well, that's correct. And Lord Grey wanted him back because by this stage, Anglesey was seen as what he was, which was a liberal, again, by 19th century standards, but a liberal and a reformer and somebody, you know, who was going to support various reforms. And Lord Grey's, which was the sort of the Whig coalition government, was very much in favour of reform. Its big policy was to reform Parliament, which had not happened in hundreds of years. And also to bring forward, they were involved in reforming slave, looking at the corn laws, all of these sort of areas. So it was felt very much that Anglesey was a good fit for that. And when he arrived, having had a very good relationship with O'Connell at the time he left, because he'd been so supportive, he'd expected something similar. But in the meantime, he appointed various people that O'Connell didn't like, and O'Connell broke with him completely. And it was a very difficult relationship there afterwards.
And I love the subtitle of your book, Worse Than War. And is the implication there that Anglesey perhaps found some of these political entanglements and clashes and strong personalities perhaps harder to deal with than engagements on the battlefield?
Well, actually, yes, definitely. But also one of the big things, a couple of things were happening in his period. Poor old Anglesey had to face, having walked into Catholic emancipation, he then had to face, there was huge agrarian disorder at the time. And then the tithe war, it blew up very much under his period when he was there as well. And of course, O'Connell started looking for repeal. And so he spent his entire time trying to bring in reforms, which he managed to get through. But at the same time, he literally was out with the military constantly trying to put out fires. And as the tithe movement went on, it's referred to as the tithe war. And of course, there were, you know, very famous incidents such as Carrickshock, where, you know, there was a lot of loss of life, both of the British forces as well as individuals. But for him, as it grew and continued, it was this, the non-dealing, which came later to be known as boycotting. It was absolutely avoiding anything to do with the British system. The whole concept of passive resistance had grown up. And so he actually said, in spite of, you know, these massive conflagrations that were happening around the country, huge meetings and everything, he actually said the passive resistance was worse than war. It was easier to take people on a battlefield than to deal with a country that had had enough. And having succeeded in getting Catholic emancipation through, was now seeking to get rid of this very hated tax that was required by everybody, including Catholics, to pay to the Anglican Church.
You say in your conclusion that he had little political experience when he came to Ireland first, but he had good intentions. And do you think in terms of his legacy and how he performed over those two occasions, did the lack of political experience show at times?
Definitely. But not always for the worse, because in fact, particularly in his first tenure dealing with Wellington, perhaps a more skillful diplomat might have fallen in with Wellington and it could have taken longer for everything to unfold. The fact of his political naivety, what he saw was this desperately needed to be addressed and it needed to be addressed now. And one of the issues that was always the case with the Lord Lieutenant in Ireland is that it was so far from London. So even though communications had improved, it was very hard to explain just how angry people were and how serious the position was on the ground. So Wellington was sitting there saying, oh, you know, we've plenty of time to do this. We need to put these people in their place. They need to understand where the boss is. And Anglesey was writing back and saying, no, this needs to be dealt with and dealt with now. So in some ways, you know, his political inexperience suited him. But at the same time, he had been a very senior leader in military campaigns. So he was somebody who was well able to manage things. So they married quite well, actually.
I find it quite funny that in the end he reconciled with Wellington and they became great friends. And it seems like and you suggest that perhaps an anniversary dinner for Waterloo brought the two men back together. And from that point on, they were extremely close.
They were extremely close. And because they had, the funny thing is, even in spite of all of the affairs with the brothers and the sisters and all the things that had gone, I mean, in fairness, that wasn't that unusual in Regency times. And they had got over that. And even over the huge row over Ireland, they moved on from it and they became extremely close. They had so much in common. Anglesey, after he left Ireland, even though he was quite old, he took up another position as the head of the ordnance and Wellington was the chief commander of the army. So they worked together a lot, but they were very close old friends. And in fact, there's a quote somewhere where someone says that they were both very deaf at the end and they used to wander into the House of Lords and conduct these very loud conversations and everybody saw them as the great grandees that they were. And they died within a couple of years of each other. They lived to be very old. And when they went, they were the passing of the last of the great Waterloo generation. But of course, they were the two leaders of the generation as well.
You suggest that he wasn't quite as popular in Ireland as he might have been. Certainly, he seems to have been very popular during the first term, but not the second. And you look at how the media reported on his various things. And it seems that perhaps some of the clashes and some of the controversies damaged his perception of how he was viewed in the country.
Well, so he was very popular at the beginning because he was there for a short period of time. He took a very prominent role and, you know, there was very little that anybody wouldn't have liked. Now, he was never terribly popular with the Protestant side of the Irish, which, of course, was a much smaller